The Venice Biennale is one of the great occasions on the visual arts calendar in non-pandemic times. It's held every 2 years in multiple locations all over the beautiful city of Venice. This year, the curator is Cecilia Almani. But along with the curated show, there are hundreds of national pavilions where individual countries present one of their artists' work this year. Ireland is represented by artist Niamh O'Malley, whose work spans drawings, printmaking, video and sculpture. Her exhibition is called Gather, and delighted to have Niamh with me in the studio this evening. Niamh, you're nominated to present Ireland at the Biennale. How does that actually work? Do you put in a proposal? Does somebody come to you and say, Niamh, you're on, get something ready for Venice?
Yeah, each country does it differently, but in Ireland, Culture Ireland puts out a call every 2 years inviting proposals from a creative team. And it's not just the artist and their idea, but a whole team who have to deliver this enormous project, do masses of fundraising, and kind of start from scratch and delivering an exhibition in quite an unusual venue.
And now you've known about this from, I think you were telling me before we came to air, 2019. There was a postponement then, was there?
Well, we started talking about it in Temple Bar Gallery and Studios, who are working with me on the project. We started talking about it in autumn 2019, and the eventual interviews, shortlisting and interviews, happened in the following year. So I think they were already delayed.
I wonder how much of an advantage is that, in fact, when, you know, to have the extra lead in time, or does work expand to fit the extra space when the deadline gets moved?
I think it does. And there were a lot of constraints on moving about and producing work during COVID. So it probably didn't give us much of an advantage in the end of the day.
Yeah, and everybody else, everywhere else was dealing with the same type of difficulties at any rate. However, not everybody is dealing with the specifics of the Irish Pavilion in the Arsenale of the Venice Biennale. Maybe describe that Arsenale to us, first of all, and then where the Irish Pavilion is within that Arsenale.
Yeah, when you enter into the Arsenale, you enter into the main part of the main exhibition, which is located in two venues, which is curated by Cecilia Almani. So you'll walk through probably what is, I suppose, a 10-minute walk if you're walking fast through
I'm not looking at anything.
Hundreds of artworks, and then you'll come turn a corner and you'll encounter the beginning of the national pavilions. And there's fascinating countries located next to us, I think, from, if memory serves me right, it's Philippines, Albania, New Zealand, Oman, Chile, Slovakia. So it's a real mix.
Yeah, yeah. But the Irish, the position of the, because there were times when the Irish pavilion or where the Irish location was moved around, but now it's set in this particular spot. It brings a certain amount of difficulty with it, doesn't it?
It does, but it's also a really beautiful space because it has a lot of daylight, and I've uncovered all the windows. I think the Architectural Biennale had them blacked out, but it's all been opened up, and it's the first point in the Arsenale where you see the water. So that may make people want to run out, but hopefully it'll make them linger and enjoy the light and the atmosphere in that particular room, which is really beautiful.
All right, well then let's talk about how you started to think about that location, because you were aware of the location. Had you visited a bit before, visited other Irish exhibitions there?
Yeah, and they've all dealt with it very differently. Some people, you know, treat it as Jesse Jones blacked out the space and had quite a kind of theatrical performative piece there. And Eva Rothschild had a series of sculptural works. So people deal with it really differently. And we've made some architectural changes to the space and taken it on, you know, in relation to the works that I've made.
All right. If we talk about the works, we'll know then how you're. It sounds to me as if that water seems to be linked into it in some way. you're taking cognizance of the fact that Venice has that innate beauty of the water just at the end of the Arsenale itself. The exhibition, your exhibition, is called Gather. Tell me a little bit about that theme, because you've quite a multidisciplinary approach to your work.
Yeah, it's an interesting word. I mean, it involves gathering objects together. I mean, to gather is to tuck or pleat or fold, as well as bringing groups of things together, but also bringing people together. And it can be, you know, gather like a command or gather an invitation. And it feels quite pertinent, I think, at the moment, because we haven't been gathering at all. And it was a title that changed in relation to COVID. We thought a lot more about things we had pitched in the original proposal, things about materiality and touch, became ever more vital and important in the show. And then this name, this title, Gather, seemed to be an important one. Will people rub up against each other for the works?
And interestingly enough, your own back garden had a certain amount of input into this. I wonder, did that come directly from, so many people spoke about during lockdown in particular, even the smallest of spaces, you really started looking at things very close to you and in your locality. How big a back garden, how small a back garden did you have, and how did it feed into what you're doing in the show?
I have a tiny back garden in Ballybock, which is about the size of a large rug. But it was very important. And, you know, when you work in making things and making spaces, and an exhibition is about making a space in a way, it's you know, you're thinking about an encounter between material kind of forms and people. And I did think a lot about how gardening was really similar, actually, when I was at home during those weeks. And we, as a family, we dug a very small pond in our very small garden and saw how that, even that action, that kind of act of making something produced a different kind of space. And in our case, it brought lots of wildlife to the garden. It kind of, it informed the show quite directly in that I made a film of a hooded crow who came to drink in that pond, and that's actually going to be in the Biennale show. So it had quite a direct impact.
So there you had it, you know, your own tiny rug-sized space presents its own set of challenges, but you use those challenges to provide you with some of the work that you have here. So if you say that one of the things that film, short film work of the hooded crow, are you projecting up onto the walls, or what are you projecting onto in terms of the space itself?
No, I'm not using projections because the work, so the space will be daylit and in fact really bright. And a brilliant thing about evolutions and sort of technology is the ability to have moving image work coexist with sculptures. So there'll be two LED screens that sit, so the kind of LED screens you see it at concerts or outdoor advertising.
So are these quite big screens?
No, one of them is really tiny. You can make them any size you want as well.
Right.
So, and one of them is really tiny. The bird is not much bigger than life size. And then there's a film of a vent, like a kind of old-fashioned metal vent with flapping louvres, and that's about 1.5 metres squared, so very much fits the sort of space of a body, and that's in the space as well.
And is that vent, that flapping vent, was that something within a very close space to you during lockdown as well?
It was found in the studio buildings. So yes, and I mean there is something about having responded to what was close at hand for sure, but it was also being conscious of the things that the sort of exhibition as a kind of space that could talk about systems of support or how you make spaces function, and then examining the things that were making the spaces function around me.
I mentioned in the introduction, obviously you've covered video within the two pieces that you've described to us, or certainly film work at any rate. Sculpture is another part of your practice. You have is there a limestone work involved in the Biennale here?
There is, yeah. I mean, I kind of position things differently in the space. So there's some very high works, which kind of are, you know, canopies which exist over your head. And then there's really weighty, heavy works that lie on the floor of the space. So I'm thinking about it as a space that you kind of move through and have all those different levels of works existing. So it's not pieces hung on walls specifically, although there are a couple. And the limestone, I was thinking about grounding people literally in the space and thinking about stone on concrete, on ground. And limestone is often what concrete is made of. And then limestone itself, the stone I have, which was sourced for me by McKeown Stone in Kilkenny, is full of fossils. And it's this beautiful sedimentary rock, which kind of speaks of itself and how it's been formed. And then they've helped me route these very deep kind of apertures in it. So it curves towards the windows in the space, like a kind of a drain-like object. And in a way, you know, this idea of producing something that talks about drainage, about water, about compression, about weight, limestone seems like the perfect material.
And
to
also,
do that.
If you're talking about water and drainage, and you're looking out, as you described, you're in Venice and you're looking out at the water just at the end of the Arsenale. And I guess grounding in Venice is very different given that you have so much water all around you. There's also a sculpture, a piece called Double Canopy. I suppose this is, that sounds as if it's higher up, one of the higher up pieces that you're talking about.
Yeah, so that is over 3 metres high, and there's two steel and aluminium structures, which are, they create a corner in the room that you could kind of inhabit. But within, if you look on this canopy as an object, it's also these two pieces that are kind of jut into each other and sort of become kind of shelters of themselves and others. So it's speaking of ideas of shelter and support as well.
Shelves are this, these are shelves and shelving are something that feature, I think, in a lot of your work to date. Does it have a particular meaning for you? Does it have a particular, what is that concept in your head, or what does it allow you to express?
Well, I'm interested in ideas of like handles and shelves and things that you, devices that you create that you could hold on to, or that you use to stack things on, and things that are very close at hand and that you know how they feel to touch. So the shelf in the exhibition in Venice will have a series of objects on it that are kind of precarious, like they could be moved about, but also highly composed and considered, as we may do in a domestic space when we place one thing beside each other. And it's thinking about that kind of deliberate and individual decision-making as well.
The exhibition opens, the Biennale opens, the 59th Biennale opens on the 23rd of April. What stage are you at now in terms of, I don't know whether you refer to this as a hang in the way you would in an exhibition. It's more of an installation, I guess. What stage are you at with that? Have you visited the space many times? How close to being finished is it?
Very close.
It would want to be, says you.
Yeah, we only managed to do one site visit during the Architectural Biennale in September, when it was a very busy space at the time. So we had to rely on images and films and sketchups of it. But we went over in early March and we installed the show then, so it could be documented for a publication. So it's actually hanging and it's covered in dust sheets and it's awaiting a final clean and a kind of uncovering in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, because it's the 23rd of April, as I say. Did you get a sense, even on that, I know it was only one site visit that you say you got a chance to do, that possibly would have been more if it weren't for travel restrictions, etc. But was there a real sense of, at last, we have the Biennale, we have an exhibition space where people will gather, to use your exhibition title, where people will rub shoulders with each other, and where some semblance of normality. Did you get a sense of that there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even the Architectural Biennale had record numbers. And so there seems to be a real urge for people to encounter things, objects, material, stuff after 2 years of virtual communication and experiences. So I think it's really important for us to go back there.
And I guess it must be a huge honour to be representing the country. It's not something that, you know, people maybe get it to do it in sport more often than they do in the arts, but it must have a great sense of affirmation about it from your colleagues.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I've been working with an amazing team and we feel very proud of a lot of the work that's going on in Ireland and hope that what we're showing is representative of that.
Well, congratulations on it all and the very best of luck with it. Hope it goes well. That's Niamh O'Malley speaking to us about her exhibition Gather, which is in the Irish Pavilion of the Venice Biennale, and the 59th International Arts Exhibition will take place from the 23rd of April right through until the 27th of November of this year in Venice. Catherine Hepburn, Woman of the Year, is a new season of the Screen Icons films at the Irish Film Institute in Dublin from this Saturday, the 9th of April. A star best known for comedies made with Cary Grant, Spencer Tracy and Humphrey Bogart, she took home 4 Oscars in all, from her screen debut in 1932, A Bill of Divorcement, to On Golden Pond in 1981, which in fact was Henry Fonda's last film. Her lifetime spanned the 20th century. She died in 2003 at the age of 96, and with her went a golden age of Hollywood. Hepburn knew controversy too, didn't shy away from it. She fought the Hollywood machine and won in 1939. More of that anon. And she spent her life with the already married Spencer Tracy, remained her own uncompromising self to the very end. Paul Whittington has been taking a look at Catherine Hepburn for us, and he joins us now. It's this season, Paul, at the IFI, Catherine Hepburn, Woman of the Year, It begins with the screwball comedies. What is it about bringing up Baby or the Philadelphia Story as a starting point? Is it a good starting point for Hepburn?
I think it's the perfect starting point, Sean. The thing about these festivals is these films used to be shown on TV in the 80s on Channel 4 and RTÉ, and they're not shown anymore. So some people say under the age of 40 might not really know who she is, and that would be a pity. Mm. But she was... not first and foremost because she was a good dramatic actress as well, but she was a wonderful comic actress, and she proved that in the late 1930s in those three very special screwballs that you mentioned, made with Cary Grant. But we now consider Bringing Up Baby to be a classic, but it was actually a flop, and it was that led to her being dubbed a box office poison.
It's extraordinary because, as you said, this is a film that I know I've seen several times on television. And you kind of wonder how could they have thought this was a flop.
Yeah.
It just gives us a sense, because Grant and Hepburn, I mean, they're kind of a bit like Tracy and Hepburn that we'll speak about later on, but they're a wonderful kind of match together in this screwball comedy type of situation that we get in Bringing Up Baby.
They're terrific together. Everybody knows how good Cary Grant was at this stuff and how effortless he made it seem, but she was wonderful, and it's very fun. He's this very dry, I think he's a paleontologist. There's a very famous scene in which she wrecks his T-Rex just after he's finished it, and basically she's just this whirlwind who comes into his life, and she realises she likes him. She has this leopard that her brother gave her that's on the loose, and it's really silly, but it's just wonderful. Barry Fitzgerald pops up in it as a gardener, a very Irish gardener, but it's so silly, but it's irresistible.
Yeah, well, let's listen to a scene, and as you've set it up there, Grant is this character, David Huxley, and Baby is the music, or the leopard called Baby is the pet of Catherine Hepburn, playing the character of Susan Vance. Cary Grant spends a lot of this scene, because never mind the patter of the thing itself, he's standing on top of a box trying to keep his distance from the cat. So as well as the very swift patter that we get, he's also doing loads of physical acting atop the box. Let's have a listen to a scene then from Bringing Up Baby.
This is probably the silliest thing that ever happened to me.
I know it's silly, but it's true. He absolutely adores the tune.
Now, what's the difference whether it adores
it's or not? It's funny that he should like such an old tune, isn't it? But I imagine that down in Brazil they probably... Listen.
Oh, stop it, Susan.
Oh,
stop.
David, let me show you.
Oh, don't do that, Susan. Don't go near the...
No, but...
Oh, dear.
Now, watch, David. You'll see he'll go right toward the music. Look at that. Isn't this remarkable? It loves it, David.
Susan, if we put the Victrola in the bathroom, will it go back in?
Oh, yes, but the music sounds better out here, and besides, he likes it.
Oh, here it comes. Oh, now, go away. Go. Oh, please, go away. Oh, my. Go away. I'm going to get out of here. Oh, Susan, I don't like leopards.
Just think of him as being a house cat, David.
Well, I don't like cats either.
Stand still, David. Don't be nervous.
That's Cary Grant as David Huxley and Catherine Hepburn as Susan Vance in the scene from Bringing Up Baby, one of the films that will be shown at the upcoming IFI season. Paul Whittington speaking to us about this evening, and even when he's flustered, Cary Grant manages to be suave. Don't
Absolutely,
know how he does it.
Yeah.
But it is Catherine Hepburn that we're speaking about here, and you get a sense of it there in that clip.
The voice.
This is a source of differences of opinion. It's always on the edge of just cracking, but I think that gives it this wonderful sense of character.
Oh, I think it's a fantastic voice. Too, the Bankhead runs rather uncharitably, called it like nickels dropping in a slot machine, but I don't think it's like that at all. I didn't know when I first heard her, when I saw these films when I was young, that there were people in America who spoke like that. She was from Connecticut. She was very New England, sort of relatively old money family. And it's astonishing, her voice, and also her person was as well. In fact, she was quite hard to share a scene with early on, and Cary Grant was able to. Some people weren't, but that voice was extraordinary. And she got it, as I say, in Connecticut. She grew up on her family's estate. She was raised. Her father was a doctor, and her mother was a suffragette and feminist. And so was Catherine Hepburn. She became famous in Hollywood for wearing trousers in the 1930s at a time when that was considered a scandalous thing to do.
Yeah, she wasn't there. An interviewer that kind of challenged her. her about wearing those trousers.
Yes, she did. It was Barbara Walters much later on television, and she said to her in an interview, she said she asked her if she owned a skirt, and Hepburn said, "I have one, Mrs. Walters. I'll wear it to your funeral." So yeah, she hated interviews, hated journalists, and just didn't do any of the flim flam at all. Really,
you'd be shocking careful about the questions you might ask somebody like that. I should have said, Bringing Up Baby, by the way, will be shown on Saturday at 4:15, 15:45. And the Philadelphia story, because I also want to play a clip from that. It's a little bit later on, and it kind of let's do the 1939 story, because this comes a little bit after that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. She started out on the stage, and she was spotted, and she went to MGM, and George Cukor, who was a great friend of hers and mentor, he cast her in a film called The Bill of Divorcement. She was great in that. She won an Oscar. She was 25, 26 in Morning Glory. But after Bringing Up Baby, which we now love, she was declared box office poison. RKO just tried to cast her in a B-movie, and she bought out her own contract, which everybody was terrified of being ostracised from the system at that time. She just bought out her contract, went back to the theatre. She had one friend, not many friends in Hollywood. She had one who was very powerful, Howard Hughes. They were romantically involved at one point. She was cast in a play, a Philip Barry play called The Philadelphia Story, and Howard Hughes bought the rights for her. So and it was a hit. So when Hollywood came looking for the rights, they had to deal with her.
Yeah. So she said, yeah, on condition.
Yeah, that I star in it, and that Cary Grant stars in it, and that Cukor directs it, and she brought in Jimmy Stewart as well. And she set up this film, which she quite deliberately realised would rehabilitate her image, in the sense that she kind of made a fool of herself at times in it.
Yeah, she plays the society heiress here, Tracy Lord, getting married to for the second time to her ex-husband, Cary Grant, as Dexter Haven, a tabloid reporter. And James Stewart, we're about to listen to a clip, in fact, featuring both of them. James Stewart as Mr. Connor in the midst of all of this as well. Here they are, after Hollywood tried to get rid of her, this is how she comes back.
Hello, fancy seeing you here.
Orange juice? Certainly.
Don't tell me you've forsaken your beloved whiskey and whiskies.
No. I've just changed their colour, that's all. I'm going for the pale pastel shades now. They're more becoming to me. How about you, Mr. Connor? You drink, don't you? Alcohol, I mean.
Oh, a little.
A little? And you a writer? I thought all writers drank to excess and beat their wives. You know, one time I think I secretly wanted to be a writer.
Dexter, would you mind doing something for me?
Anything, what?
Get the heck out of here.
Oh, my dear Red, I couldn't do that. That wouldn't be fair to you. You need me too much.
Would you mind telling me just what it is you're hanging around for? Oh, no. Please don't go, Mr. Connor.
Oh, no. Please don't go, Mr. Connor. As a writer, this ought to be right up your street.
Don't miss a word.
I never saw you looking better, Red. You're getting that fine, tawny look.
Oh, we're going to talk about me, are we? Goody.
Catherine Hepburn as Tracy Lord, Cary Grant as Dexter Haven, and James Stewart as Mr. Connor, in the midst of all of that, the scene from Philadelphia Story 1940. And that Philadelphia Story will be showing as part of this IFI season, Catherine Hepburn Woman of the Year, at 3:30 on Sunday afternoon. That's Sunday, April the 10th. So that's a great way to start it out, Bringing Up Baby on Saturday, the Philadelphia Story on Sunday. But you did say, Paul Whittington, looking at both Catherine Hepburn and the programme for this season for us, you did say that she bought out the contract, her RKO contract.
Yeah.
That kind of lets us know she was brought up with not a silver spoon, a whole canteen of cutlery in her mouth, you could argue.
Well, in one sense as well. I mean, they weren't fabulously wealthy, but yeah, by the standards of the day, they certainly were. But I think she was more than that. She was brought up, she said later in life, I didn't find out until recently that women were supposed to be inferior. She just didn't behave like a woman.
Like a woman was expected to behave at that time.
She wanted to do things on their own terms, the way that men did, and she managed to do it. And that film, as I said, did resurrect her career. There are caveats with the Philadelphia Story now, which is a film I love, in that some of its sexual politics is a bit outdated. Her father appears to blame her for his own affair at one point, and so forth. And everybody's always preaching to her about that women should be softer than she is, but somehow she just wins out anyway. And then a year after that, when she was back on track, she met Spencer Tracy.
And how much did that change both her career and her life?
Well, I think it changed her career in the sense that prior to those screwballs we talked about, she had been considered primarily a dramatic actress, and on the stage she would do Shakespeare later. But with Spencer Tracy in Woman of the Year, which was their first film together, they just established this wonderful rapport, and the films were very current in terms of their... They were approaching sexual politics in a way that we would find rather timid, but was not seen at the time. And they went on to make 8 films together, and of course they also fell in love. He was an Irish-American. He was quite a difficult man, I think. Well, he was an alcoholic and he suffered with depression. He also refused to leave his wife, but Hepburn and he effectively lived together until his death in 1967, and she was devoted to him and also was very careful. She didn't go to the funeral so as not to offend his wife and so on. But she was devoted to him.
And I would guess if you were an interviewer of the time and you even broached that subject, you might find yourself getting an answer worse than the one told to the reporter who asked about the trousers.
Well, there are lots of great quotes that of her dismissing journalists. There was another one about her when she was older. Again, this journalist asked her, do you fear death? And she said, no, not at all. Then I wouldn't have to talk to you. So she was terrific. I would have loved to have interviewed her just to see what happened.
Well, you'd have to be prepared to lob up the ball and let her smash it back.
Oh, you would.
And that's perfectly acceptable in many situations. The African Queen then comes along in 1951. Again, many's a Sunday afternoon was sat in front of the black and white African Queen. I mean, an extraordinary film. And it's so sad that we don't get to see them regularly on television now, isn't it?
It is very sad. She wrote this memoir, it's very good actually, which I read years ago, called Me, which is wonderful. And she talked about that shoot and John Huston, who was very impressed with how, because everybody will know he was like a hunter and an outdoorsman and drank whiskey all the time. She was well able to keep up with him. And she was very fond of Bogart because Tracy and Bogart were friends. And she was very proud of that film, and because it's not just a comedy, it's extremely touching as well. You know, she's this kind of spinster type, which she got cast as in her 40s, by the way. That's how things used to go. And he played this drunken boatman, and they end up doing something heroic. But it is a very charming film. And as you say, it's very sad that we don't get to see those anymore on the television.
All right, well, let's have a listen to a conversation on the boat, the African Queen being the name of the boat, obviously, that Bogart and Hepburn are on. And here they are. I don't know whether she's worried about him or he's worried about her. Let's have a listen.
Just why don't you want to go on, Mr. Olnut?
The river. As Shona.
Shona?
You're darn right, Shona. All it would take would be one bullet in the blasting gelatin and we'd be a little bit for pieces.
Then we'll go by night.
Oh, no, we won't. After Shona, there's the rapids, and nobody that might ride would tackle the rapids at night.
But then we'll go in the daylight. We'll go on the far side of the river from Shona just as fast as ever we can.
Oh, no, we won't.
You agreed to go.
I never did. I never agreed to nothing.
You are a liar, Mr. Allnut. And what is worse, you are a coward.
Ooh, coward yourself. You ain't no lady. No, miss. That's what my poor old mother would say to you.
Humphrey Bogart as Charlie Allnut there, and Catherine Hepburn as Rose Sayre, and John Huston, the director, obviously, of African Queen 1951, another one of the films that's showing in the IFI season. In fact, that one's showing not this coming Saturday, but Saturday week, the April the 16th at 15:45, 4:15, The African Queen. That, in many ways, it kind of, for me, is the quintessential, and for many people, I think, the quintessential Hepburn role. Yes, she's straight-laced, and yes, she's uptight, but there's so much underneath what she's doing. It's not just this closed-off person that you can't get to. There's an awful lot of running underneath all of it.
Yeah, no, she has restraint but also is able to show all the emotion underneath, as you say. And in fact, of course, that, not to spoil that for anybody who hasn't seen it, but they do end up sort of falling in love. She was kind of criticised for her restraint and her emotional restraint in her life. And some people connected to her brother committed suicide when she was a teenager and she had found him. But again, it was a double standard because men of the time, American men who were sort of tight-lipped and emotionally restrained, they were called heroes, but it wasn't acceptable in a woman. And yet she just did what she did. And there's a sense in which her range was narrow and she was always in some way playing herself. And yet she was able to do so much within that.
Yeah, but she made no apologies that she was playing herself. She said, that's what I'm not putting, I am putting words in her mouth, that's what I do best, playing myself.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And just her whole, her voice, her bearing, she was inimitable. And I think we might be talking about another film. She had to find a really strong actor to play opposite her. And I think we're going to talk about Peter O'Toole in a minute, because
this is Lion in Winter, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because they were wonderful together in that.
Well, we'll talk about them right now. Lion in Winter, into the 1960s, actually, you know, because even in the 1960s, she had Long Day's Journey Into Night, she had Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So she only makes three films, but those are the three she makes. Long Day's Journey Into Night, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and the one that we're talking about now, The Lion in Winter. Do you put this decade possibly where she gives us, maybe not her best work, but a whole new side to her work?
Yes, I think so. And I think a side that she had been showing on stage for some time, but not necessarily on film, because she had become synonymous to some extent with romantic comedies. And I mean, probably my favourite of all the films she did. I do like Long Day's Journey Tonight. She was very good in that. But I do love her in The Lion in Winter. And I love those scenes between the two of them, because they're big enough for each other as actors, you know.
Yeah, and there's an historical aspect to this. Obviously, we're in the 12th century. Catherine Hepburn as Eleanor of Aquitaine. Peter O'Toole as her husband, King Henry II. Jane Marrow as Alice here, a young woman raised as one of the family and now the king's lover. And here's a conversation between Henry and Eleanor.
Henry?
Mm-hmm.
I have a confession.
Yeah.
I don't much like our children. Only you, the child I raised but didn't bear.
You never cared for me.
I did and do, believe me. Henry's bed is Henry's province. He can people it with sheep for all I care. Which on occasion he has done.
Rosamond's been dead for 7 years.
2 months and 18 days. I never liked her much.
You count the days.
I made the numbers up. He found Miss Clifford in the mists of Wales and brought her home for closer observation. Liking what he found, he scrutinized her many years. He loved her deeply and she him. And yet, my dear, when Henry had to choose between his lady and my lands...
There is no sport in hurting me. It's so easy.
After all the years of loving care, do you think I could bring myself to hurt you?
Eleanor, with both hands tied behind you.
Jane Marrow as Alice there, knowing exactly the power that not only Eleanor but Catherine Hepburn has, and Peter O'Toole there as her husband, as Eleanor's husband, that is, King Henry II, from The Lion in Winter, 1968 film. Paul, that was the third of her four Oscars.
Yes.
What was the final Oscar for, by the way?
On Golden Pond, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Henry Fonda's last film, yeah.
Yeah, that was Henry Fonda's final film, yeah. And that was, there was so much talk.
But you know
about
what, Sean? She never went to the Oscars, which I love. She didn't turn up. Something like that.
Wouldn't let her in her trousers, probably, would they? So then when we have people like Dorothy Parker talking about she runs the gamut of emotions all the way from A to B, what was she talking about?
Well, it's a good line, isn't it? But I think she caught her very odd in her stage career. And you can hear that there is there can be a kind of staccato effect to the way she speaks. But if you listen to it at all, I was listening to that clip there from The Lion in Winter. It's like a musical instrument or something, as was O'Toole's voice for that matter. But there's so much within it and her voice is so powerful. And you can tell that she spent a lot of time on the stage because... it's that good.
Yeah, and that cracked quality is what always gets me there. It's kind of what makes it work for me. And indeed, those two films, those final films that we spoke about, The Lion in Winter, 1968 film, will be shown on Tuesday, April 26th, and on Golden Pond on April the 30th. Lots of others in between as well, but you can find out full details of those on ifi.ie. Paul, thanks for speaking to us this evening.
Thanks, Paul.
Whittington talking to us about Catherine Hepburn, Woman of the Year, runs at the Irish Film Institute in Dublin from the 9th through until the 30th of April. ifi.ie, as I said, for full details on that. The Cúirt International Festival of Literature, currently running in Galway. Tomorrow, Thursday, Wendy Erskine and Colin Barrett will be taking part in an event called Away Home, Short Stories and Estrangement. Wendy Erskine's new collection is called Dance Move, and we're about to hear a reading from the collection called Nostalgie, where Drew, who had an earlier brief career as the front singer in a band, is flattered to be asked to sing his old hits and takes up the invitation to travel to the north, even though it is for some former paramilitaries. The reader here is the author herself.
Drew drops his final cigarette into the night sea, and heads back to the cabin, a family type with two sets of bunks. He looks at its wood laminate as he drinks the bottle of whiskey he bought, thinking of all the holidays the four of them have taken over the years. The beds in hotels, villas and cottages that had been theirs for a week or so. A surprise that their almost adult kids came in that last one to Cyprus. The promise of winter sun. One night, in the hotel bar, a waiter passed plastic sheets round the tables, lists of songs for karaoke. When he brought the next tray of drinks, Drew handed the lists back to him. That night, at the karaoke, the singers were drunk and pitiful, apart from one woman, not terribly young, who sang so beautifully, the room went preternaturally quiet. When she finished, Drew realised he'd been holding his breath. His eyes were wet. He saw the woman afterwards, loading deck chairs and other beach paraphernalia into the boot of her car.
Wendy Erskine there reading from her story Nostalgie, which is from her recent collection Dance Move. And Wendy will be part of an event with Colin Barrett on Thursday evening. It's called Away Home, Short Stories and Estrangements, part of the Cooch International Festival of Literature. You can find out full details on cooch.ie. Lorna McVeigh's new novel Lenny contains two connected tales in one. 10-year-old Lenny lives in a dying town in the Bayou of Louisiana, a place threatened by pollution from a chemical company. In the other, an injured American pilot is cared for by nomads in the Libyan desert while he tries to recover his memory. Lenny is a novel of childhood, time and imagination, of the lies we tell ourselves and the need for story to make sense of our world. It's Laura's second novel, made her debut in 2017 with Under the Almond Tree, about a young refugee living in Afghanistan. I'm delighted to have Lorna McVeigh, who joins us now from her home in Mallorca. You're telling two very different stories here and two very different locations. And we were in Afghanistan with your first novel. You're talking to us from Mallorca. You clearly like, maybe both in reality and in your imagination, to travel quite a bit. Which did you start out with here in Lenny, Laura? Did you start out with the young Lenny in Louisiana, or did you start out with this American air pilot called Goose in the Libyan desert?
Yeah, so when I started the novel, the first kind of spark really for me was actually to do with the fact that for quite a while, I'd known that I was interested in writing a story that would be in conversation with the writing of Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, who obviously is very well known for his classic fable, The Little Prince, but who wrote lots of other wonderful things and was also an aviator. And one of the things that happened to him was that he crashed a plane in the Libyan desert and was rescued by a Bedouin on a camel, and that became the spark, really, for the story of Lenny, because when I opened the novel, it opens with a pilot falling from the sky in 2011, and he's rescued by a young boy and taken in by his family. So that was really kind of how I started into the story, and obviously I became very fascinated by the desert, almost as a character, within the novel itself.
Yeah, and did you actually visit the Libyan desert, or how did you? I mean, because the descriptions of the various nomadic tribes, or the one particular nomadic tribe, and the young boy who becomes particularly close to Goose, the American aviator who has crash landed in the desert. I mean, they're so precise. Did you visit there, or how did you go about learning about that?
I mean, obviously, Libya isn't somewhere that you can visit really very easily at all.
No one have thought.
At the moment, but I have, you know, I have spent time in North Africa, and I have, you know, camped out under the stars and with the Bedouin and that. So I think there were elements that I could connect to in that kind of a way. But also, the novel, obviously, it's set in a particular moment in time. So a lot of the research for the book is very much focused on that time period and the particular circumstances, you know, for those settings at those times. And really, when I was then thinking of the other narrative thread. I wanted something that was very, very different to the Libya setting. And as I was researching, it was kind of coming across, I think it was a fact about how landmass in southern Louisiana was disappearing more quickly than anywhere else on Earth.
Yeah,
and being swallowed up by water. And I just was intrigued, you know, what's going on here. So that then really sort of drew me in, and I started to look at all of that much more closely, and find that there were so many kind of resonances with the kinds of themes and ideas that I was interested in exploring in the book.
I think one of the ideas that really started to come out to me in the Louisiana section of the novel was obviously what we're doing as human beings to our planet. And the specifics of the activities of chemical companies in and around this town of Roseville in Louisiana. Just tell us a little bit about what's going on there and the type of threat that it is to the entire community.
Yeah, well, the story of Roseville, so Lenny's home within the novel, it's a fictional town. It's not an actual place. And I've situated it on the kind of the curve of Falls River. But the part of the river that runs really from Baton Rouge, just below that, down to New Orleans, is sort of an 85-mile stretch, which has been termed Cancer Alley. And the residents who live there along the waterways have campaigned for many, many years because of the health problems that they have suffered. And there is an incredibly high level of industrial activity in that region. So that was something that became very key within the novel, really thinking about, the way in which we treat the land that you know, it's home, it's someone's home, and look at what we're doing to it. So that's something that Lenny's very much fighting against within the story.
Yeah, and the Lenny that is he's the title character of the novel. The Lenny appears in that Roseville aspect of the story, and he's about 9 or 10 at the point when we meet him in that. But it strikes me that the way we treat the land, there are kind of connections between that and, am I saying it correctly, the Imuhar, the nomadic group that the young boy in the Libyan part of the story, Azil, who is with the American aviator, are you looking at the contrast between the way that those nomadic
exactly.
groups treat the land?
Well, I was interested in lots of different aspects of, you know, looking at obviously desertification and what's happening with the desert. And again, you know, I was fascinated to read a lot about sort of the Green Sahara, you know, 6,000 years ago, that the Sahara Desert would have been full, it would have been very lush, very green, full of antelope and elephants and giraffe, and that you can see, you know, you can see cave drawings to that effect still. You can find fossils of shells, you know, in the sand. And so it's that idea of, I suppose, possibility, you know, the other possibilities that exist for the planet and the choices that we're taking. And how all of these things obviously are so interconnected. So although they seem like very different settings, it's really about the connections between all these different elements of our world.
Yeah, and another connection is in the Louisiana section of the novel, we have a character called Lucy, who's a librarian, who in fact gives the book The Little Prince to the young Lenny. So there's a nice little link across there. And Lenny is in this situation. He's in a very difficult situation. His mother has left the family home. His father, Jim, has a serious drink problem and barely able to look after Lenny, it has to be said. But there's a character in this section that really, there was something about her. There was a kind of a Miss Havisham feel to it in some ways, and this faded beauty feel to it as well. The Julie character, Julie Betterdine Valerie, if I'm saying her name correctly, she's still waiting on her fiancé who, well, we presume something happened to him in the Korean War. She's still sitting there in Roseville waiting for him to come back. Terrible sadness in that.
Yeah, and she hopes, you know. She hopes and she wants to believe. And I think one of the things that I wanted to explore with the other characters within the novel is that sense of vulnerability that we all carry, you know, that we're all broken in different ways, or that sense of loneliness that everyone can experience. And I think it's something that she, in particular, has really had to find ways of dealing with throughout her life. But she held on to hope.
Yeah, hope is a very important aspect in the book, in fact. And is that, when you're writing about the terrible treatment that the planet is getting from the likes of those chemical companies in America and all over the world, let's be honest, and then, that, as you mentioned, the Sahara being this wonderful place almost 6,000 years ago and then total desertification in our lifetime, is it difficult to hold hope in the midst of the kind of climate crisis that we're in now?
I think the story, what I'm trying to do within it is really just to pose a series of questions and to say, what are the other ways that we could do this? What are the other possibilities that exist for us? And I think we have to hold on to that hope. We have to believe that individual actions can make a difference.
You were born and bred in Northern Ireland, Laura. How much do you want to tell me about Jim's background in that respect?
So Jim, in the novel, he grew up in the north of Ireland. He has an American mother and a father from Northern Ireland. And so within the novel, we see a little bit about his childhood, and in particular his love of the stars, and he really enjoys stargazing and thinking about the world beyond this one. But then, life happens, and when we come to Jim in the story, he's really dealing with quite a lot. In particular, he's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And that was something that I was very interested in writing about. It's, inevitably, I think, connected to having grown up in the north, that, you're always mindful of conflict and the impact of conflict on individual lives. So that's something that we see through Jim's eyes in the story.
There's one other character that I wanted to talk a little bit about. That's Wild River Sal, a wonderful character in the Louisiana section of it. We won't get into how and why she's part of the story, but she kind of presents to us in some ways this possibility that there's a very thin veil between the various worlds, the various places that might exist. It's not quite supernatural, but it's something different from that, I think. How would you describe it?
I think there is a touch of just that which we don't know or don't understand, things that are perhaps a little bit beyond us, but it doesn't mean that they don't exist or they can't happen. I think the way that you've described it, that sense of being between two places, is very apt.
I noticed too that there, when I was reading the book, I couldn't help seeing the cinematic nature of the book itself. Were you aware of that writing it? Is there any talk about a kind of a cinematic realization?
I think I tend to write in quite a visual way. When I'm writing the story, I see it, as I'm writing it. So that definitely happens. And then I have a love of film and cinema, and I'm sure that has an influence on the writing.
Well, I wouldn't be at all surprised. It wouldn't be at all surprised to see a film version in time to come. Thanks for speaking to us this evening, Laura. That's Laura McVeigh, author of Lenny, which is published by New Island.